Welcome back for part two of the Tara Lake Show. Later in my conversation with Chike, I asked him about the H1N1 swine flu, the vaccination debate, his own work, and his personal message to the president.
Another reason that I really wanted to talk to you, you are currently at Yale. You're an MD PhD student. Are you wrapping up your PhD this semester?
Yes, I am. I actually submitted it on October 1st, so it's complete, and I'm giving my thesis seminar. I actually already gave my defense, but it's a public thesis seminar on very, very soon, so it's all done.
Okay, cool. So I can call you Dr. Chike.
Well,
I mean, because I like the way it sounds.
No, it kind of does. It has a bit of a ring to it. We'll see.
I think it does. But you are also you're also in the process of working on your MD as well. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you work on very closely is infectious diseases. You happen to have a forthcoming article. You're the lead author on a forthcoming article. Predicting virus evolution, the relationship between genetic robustness and the evolvability of thermal tolerance. And I'm going to have to go to the library and check that out. That's forthcoming. When should we be able to see that?
It's actually in press now. So it just came out, actually. So actually, if you look online now, it actually is available.
Awesome. Yes. Okay, so I'm going to get my dictionary, and I'm going to plow through it. It was one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. Of course, we are in the midst of real national concern about the H1N1 swine flu virus. And there's been a lot of discussion on articles in the media looking at the attitudes towards vaccination with H1N1 swine flu. And I've already been teasing you about my own attitudes about vaccination. But I wanted to hear from you just in terms of your thoughts about that. Are we taking it seriously enough? Are there some things that we ought to be thinking about that we're not talking about enough? Just your take on that issue generally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yes, as you can imagine, this is one that I've tried to I think deeply about, and I'm personally connected to it, and I'm professionally connected to it, and sometimes the personal and the professional aren't necessarily linked to each other, and I change views on things every once in a while. I mean, overall, I think I have a pretty good handle on what went on with H1N1. As you know, H1N1 started popping up in April of 2009. Obviously, it was probably around a lot longer than that, but that's when we first started seeing cases of it in Mexico and in the southwestern United States. It's one of those situations where it was definitely a disease looks like we hadn't seen before. And of course, the media took it and sprinted with it, and we had our doomsday virus that was going to wipe everybody out, like you kind of have in the comics and the science fiction stories. Of course, that is certainly not the case. And I think the key is you have overreaction and then you have negligence, and I think it's trying to find out where in the middle is the appropriate way to go. Mm-hmm. On October 25th, President Obama declared a national emergency. Some people said that was a little bit much. Some people said it wasn't enough. And I think now is the time we really need to get a little bit of clarity on it. H1N1 is basically a type of influenza. It's a subtype of H1N1 that has combinations of genes from the four major subtypes of influenza from various continents. And I think that's what makes it new. If you actually look at its symptoms, and you actually look at its characteristics, it's not substantially worse than many seasonal flus. If there's anything good that's come from the H1N1 publicity, is that it's alerted us to how bad regular flu is. Regular flu, the regular seasonal flu that we get every year, actually kills thousands of people every year. That now people realize that flu is a major, major killer every year, that we need to get a handle on this public health concern so that we can kind of address it every year, regardless of whether or not it's swine flu or not. The vaccine issue, and I think that's kind of the one that's very, very sensitive, and I think it's kind of cut across political lines and religious lines and professional lines, and I think that's where things have gotten contentious.
Hold on just a moment, because my first thought is to take you back. One of the things about H1N1 is that it's not necessarily, in terms of its severity, necessarily worse than other flus. But this is just me, and this is just a person looking at media perception, mm-hmm. but it seems that perhaps a lot of people are paying closer attention to this flu because of the young people who are dying or being impacted by H1N1.
Yes.
And I wonder if I'm getting the sense that that is unusual, that this sort of group of, you know, somewhere between children and very young adults, that this is not something that's necessarily seen, that the severity isn't necessarily worse, but that the population is different. Do you think that's impacting our perceptions?
Yeah, some of the demographic shifts are slightly different. The thing is, children in general, when their immune systems are not particularly developed, die of infections a lot easier. Mm-hmm. The other groups that we worry about for H1N1 are some of the same groups we worry about for a lot of infectious diseases, pregnant women and the elderly. So I would say in general that's not the case. I mean, in general, there's a reason why we vaccinate children in general, or there's a reason why people believe we should vaccinate people in general, and that's because children's immune systems are not developed and they cannot defend themselves. It's really, the differences are not substantial. It looks like H1N1 is a little bit more virulent, as we call it, potentially in some groups, but it certainly isn't on the order of the disparity they get in terms of media coverage.
Okay. One of the things that you just pointed out was the concept of vaccination as more than a health issue, but that vaccination is also an issue that has social implications as well as health implications and religious implications and cultural implications, and that all of that is sort of part of the discussion on vaccination. But I wonder if you could go from there and talk to us a bit more about what has really become a controversy around whether or not to vaccinate for the H1N1 swine flu virus.
Okay, so the issue, really, I think the issue began several years ago when there was a study that purported connection between a vaccine and a preservative in the vaccine, thimerosal, which has mercury in it, and it purported there's a connection between it and autism in children. And I think that began the firestorm. And that one was published in a medical journal, a leading medical journal. And I think there was a lot of kind of like, it was a huge backlash against the vaccine movement because of that. And insofar as it was correct, you know, that's fair. I mean, I think that's the key here is everyone, we all need to stop holding on to whatever we have in terms of our, you know, morality in the face of evidence. And insofar as the evidence kind of tells us something, even if we don't want to believe it, I'm obligated as a future clinician and as a scientist to back what I feel is the responsible data. Unfortunately for that study, it was one of the authors recanted it, and the Institute of Medicine, you know, in 2004 did a widespread study of the connection between vaccines and autism and found no connection. Now, that was not, of course, the end of the debate. That was kind of the beginning of the debate because that tore the community as a whole right in half. You have these people, many of them scientists, pediatricians, who are, I guess we would call them pro-vaccine, in the sense that they believe that there isn't a connection between preservatives and vaccines and autism and other neurological problems or other health problems. Then you have this other camp who are very, very anti-vaccine and think that they're unnatural, think that to inject young children with foreign substances can't be healthy. And I think that's kind of where the status quo lies right now. And I think I'm not sure which direction it's actually leaning towards because you have, again, Republicans, Democrats, people of all religions who are on all sides of this debate. Now, that's kind of a summary.
So now, Dr. Chike, I respect your perspective. I certainly know that you have a long history of study, research, and practice. So now I'd like to hear your take on this issue from your perspective.
Sure. Okay. I was trying to put off my opinion for as long as possible.
You know we're going to let you do that, though. So go
all right.
Bring it back.
So,
okay.
All right. So I'm going to be clear but cautious, okay? And I think I definitely enthusiastically and an ardent supporter of vaccines for young children and vaccines in the population because I think that the consequences of not having vaccinated the population for a lot of the infections we have are very, very dire based on what I know about epidemiology and the way epidemics spread. There hasn't been a single bigger weapon against the spread of infectious diseases than vaccines. The vaccine technology, the vaccinology as a science in the field has saved, I mean, the number of lives it has saved, the number of deaths it's prevented, you kind of can't even count it at this stage. I think part of the issue is that is desensitized to this and doesn't really see its importance. I think that's because we vaccinate our children. I think in places where you don't have a strong vaccine program, you're starting to see some meningitis deaths now because people are not vaccinating their children. And I think that's kind of one of the main concerns. That is definitely where I lie in terms of my opinion. That said, I think there's an obligation from people who think like me to responsibly and compassionately engage the other side, because the other side isn't necessarily born out of ideological ignorance or anything like that, and so dismissiveness gets us nowhere. It's born out of the fact that people care about the health of children, and I think that's the key. People care about the health of children, and if you're a parent and you hear that something that you're putting in this child's body is going to lead to autism, well, you're going to be reluctant too, and unfortunately and fortunately, with the internet, you have easy access to all this information. And so the anti-vaccine movement has celebrities, Jenny McCarthy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and so it has visibility. Unfortunately, you have that versus the science, and the science can't really keep up. I think it's the science's responsibility to be clear, to be done responsibly, and to kind of engage these people in a fair debate. But I would say that in the face of the evidence that I evaluate, and again, I don't really have an ideological tie to either side. I'm interested in what the people in the public need to stay healthy. There's something called herd immunity. Herd immunity is basically, it's how much of a given population needs to be vaccinated in order to avoid an epidemic. If you have a higher percentage than of the population that's vaccinated, then herd immunity. If you have above herd immunity, then an infectious disease can't propagate and it can't cause an epidemic. It'll die out. And what the problem is, with fewer and fewer people being vaccinated, fewer and fewer children getting vaccines, you're going to get to a point with some of these illnesses, like a meningitis, you're going to get to a point where if you're below herd immunity and you're going to get epidemics and young people are going to die. So that's where I rest in the debate.
Now I have to say this, because I thought you said some really beautiful things about engaging the other side and really providing a fair opportunity for debate. So, I'm the other side, okay? I'm not a parent. I'm a young adult. I'm hearing a lot of information about getting this flu shot, this H1N1 flu shot. I've never had any flu shots before, I feel that I got a lot of great antibodies from my mom, and then she got some from her mom, and hey, I'm eating my raw collard greens, I'm eating my jalapeno peppers. I'm just keeping it real. I'm eating my roasted garlic. And I just don't feel a personal necessity. What might you say to someone like me? Because I got to say, I'm not really feeling the whole heading over to the pharmacy, putting down $30 and having something shot into my arm or up my nose. So what might you say to someone like me if you were to, engage me respectfully and thoughtfully, Dr. TK, what might you say?
Okay, so great. But I think there's two issues here. What would I say to you in the specific case of H1N1, or what would I say to you in general? Okay, I think.
Yeah.
These are two, but we'll just both. In the case of H1N1, let's talk about what you just said, which is very, very clear, and it's a specific issue. H1N1, swine flu, as is publicly known, it ranges in severity. I work with college kids. Some of them have it, and typically they're gone for a few days, and they come back, and they're fine. About 5 days, between three days and a week, usually, and they come back, and they're fine. Fairly similar to regular seasonal flu. And so, in which case, if you don't want to get vaccinated against H1N1 for that reason, that's your right. That's your right, because generally speaking, and young children, the elderly, pregnant women, there's certain groups that really, really should be getting the vaccine, in my opinion. But if you're not in any one of those groups, I think they recommend 6 months, infants to young adults to get the vaccine. If you're not in any one of those groups, and you're fine, you don't want to get the flu shot, that's your personal right. I think the issue comes into, in your case, Tara Lake, that's fine, that's your right. And I think that, I think that's your perfectly fine right. I think the issue, it becomes a little hairier when we think about different groups. For example, healthcare workers who don't want to get the H1N1 vaccination. when you have parents who, pregnant women who don't want to get the H1N1 vaccination, or people who have children who don't, I think that's where the debate comes in. But on a personal level, this is one of those situations where, you know, your autonomy, you exercise your own autonomy, and if you take care of yourself, you actually have a good scientific point. If you take care of yourself and you're responsible and you wash your hands and you do these things like that, the evidence points towards the probability that you'll get any of this stuff being, you know, lower than normal. Or not that you will get it, but that you'll, you know, definitely have eating well and having a strong immunity, eating your vegetables is good for kind of handling any infectious disease, including the flu.
That's cool. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to sort of look at that topic from many different angles. And I want to take you to one more place. Now, you know, I'm not going to hold you all day because I have a pot of greens on the stove right now. So I'm not going to, you know, drag it out. But I want to talk to you just a little bit about Chike, or Dr. Chike, because I really like that. But now I wanted to talk to you a little bit about just your professional plans. Another thing that I'd like to do at the Tara Lake Show is to talk to young people who I really think are taking the opportunity to make the most of their lives and of their gifts. And I think that you're certainly a person who has done that and who continues to do that. And so I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what your plans are at this point. Now, I mentioned that you finished up your PhD work. You're still there at Yale. You're still pursuing your MD. You know, you've taken opportunities to work with UNICEF. You've taken opportunities to work on health issues in Kenya, both as a student scholar and also as a consultant. You've done a lot of different work, and I'm wondering what your plans are at present, where you're heading.
Oh, it's a $1 million question.
So, go ahead. Start there.
No, please.
Yeah, I was going to, the other thing I was thinking too is that certainly your history reflects an interest in certain issues, certainly infectious diseases, I see that. But I also see a commitment already in your career to health issues on the continent and in Kenya and elsewhere. And so you can talk about that as well. Just go for it.
No, certainly. All this is kind of tied together. And I think what's beautiful about the way I'm about life is kind of it takes these interesting angles and directions. It's enabled me to explore different things and kind of try to put different things together and tie the different interests together. So in my case, I've had this kind of personal, I have a very personal experience. I've been growing up in kind of a little bit less than fortunate, you know, circumstances, you know, in a single mom, and I kind of developed very, very early a kind of political interest in poverty and in race and in kind of disenfranchisement and in social justice. And that's just kind of secondary to my upbringing in New York. As I grew older, and I kind of had a troubled high school experience. I wasn't really, really too good as a student in high school. As I grew older, my mom, I always say, if she was born in today's day, she would be the greatest scientist ever. Of course, she was born, you know, an African-American woman in Baltimore, you know, in the 40s and 50s, and so it was different for her. She had this love of science, and she kind of taught me to love science and the natural world and the biological world, and I kind of carried this with me through college. And so since college, I've basically looked for ways that I can tie these interests together. Can I use my interest and passion in science to kind of do relevant things for the communities that I'm most interested in? And fortunately, I've been able to do that, as you mentioned, with kind of the work in Kenya where I studied malaria, and I decided infectious diseases would be a good way to kind of address both of these things, because infectious diseases are the ones that kill and affect the poor of the world. And that means both domestically and certainly internationally, as we've read about the international AIDS pandemic, as we learned about the malaria pandemic and the tuberculosis problem. So I think that's why I chose infectious diseases. Now, I chose to do my PhD work in infectious diseases, but I'm doing something very, very interesting, as you alluded to. I'm trying to look at evolution and ecology of infectious diseases, because really when you look at the infectious disease problem, unlike diabetes and unlike, you know, hypertension and chronic disease and other chronic diseases, infectious diseases, we are our enemy in that is another organism. It's another living organism that has interests of its own. And so if you look at the things that are causing us the most problems, it's their ability to adapt and change.
Okay. Yes.
And if I can look at ways to, and I saw on the paper, if we can predict ways that they're going to adapt and change, then we can come up with better strategies to counteract them and kind of design drugs and vaccines to potentially prevent the infections. And so that's kind of informed my current paradigm. After this, I will train in pediatrics, and more than likely we'll do a fellowship in infectious diseases, and I hope to kind of run a research program. I hope to see patients in an inner-city community, and I hope to teach and train the next generation of physicians, nurses, and scientists.
Okay, that's a wonderful plan. Just amazing. And you know what else, too? One more thing. I'm noticing in this show that I've had a kind of thread with some of my guests in that they went to Florida A&M University, as I did. So I wanted to make it clear, you mentioned college, you didn't mention your institution. What was that university again?
That would be the HU, Howard University.
Right.
Yes.
And
yes,
I just want to make it clear to the listeners that I still love you because you didn't know.
Oh. How could you not? I went to HU.
And you know, hey, that's fine. You know, I just
I got love for FAMU. I got love.
And you know what? And I have love for Howard. And I, anytime is an awesome opportunity to point out the amazing role that our stellar historically Black colleges and universities have had in preparing not just academically, but also I think giving students the opportunity to really explore the social issues that can so richly inform our professional lives. So I know you didn't talk much about that, but did Howard have any impact at all in your journey toward your professional decisions in that sense?
Yes. I think the thing about Howard University, I have a very kind of roundabout way of answering questions. I'll answer that one quickly and directly. Yes, I did not have role models growing up. And I had this moment when I went to Howard where I realized where everything changed for me. I'll never forget this. I'd never known any Black doctors or scientists. I met a physical chemist. His name was Dr. Vernon Morris. I'll never forget this. He was a young African-American guy. And he's sitting in the room. I'm looking at him like, what? And he's like, yeah, you know, I study physical chemistry and electrons and this and that. And I'm 17 years old. I'm looking at him like, no way. And then I remember he said, if you want to contact me, he writes his email address on the board. And it was something at Wu-Tang or something. Wu-Tang was my favorite, for kids that don't know. It was my favorite hip-hop group back then, a long time ago. And to kind of see that, you know, in his email address, from who was then an associate professor in physical chemistry, completely changed my life. And I think that's, I tell that story because that really kind of symbolizes what the HBCU experience was like for me. It was very, for kids who didn't really, really have a lot to identify with, it was the most inspiring thing in the world. And I think my understanding of what was possible grew exponentially the minute I got there. So, yes, very much so.
That's beautiful. So thank you so much for that. Thank you, Howard University, for Dr. TK. November is actually, as you know, the anniversary of the election of our current president, Barack Obama. And the first show that I did with this project before I decided to make this a monthly project, that was a year ago. And that was the Barack Obama block party. So I'm not doing a Barack Obama wrap up at this point. I'm holding that. I'm holding that for a couple of more months. If there is anything that you would like to say to the president, any message that you have to President Obama or regarding President Obama or his administration. So this is your opportunity, man. Maybe he'll hear it.
You know, I'm not going to, unlike most things I try to do in the show when it's controversial, I'm not going to skate around this one, but I'll try to address it directly. But what I will say is this. I think the key for President Obama is I want him to really, really be clear about what his decision is here. He has a choice between doing what he believes and potentially sacrificing re-election and doing what everyone else wants him to do, in increasing the probability of re-election. And I know he's very more than smart enough to understand this kind of position that he's in, but I hope he recognizes that his election was historic, and so the historical nature of it is already done. I hope that he uses the next few years to kind of push for a public option in healthcare, which he has, to make real, real changes in terms of our place internationally, which he's certainly has done verbally, kind of haven't seen it yet we haven't seen it kind of complete on the ground. But really, really taking his mind off re-election and putting his mind on actually improving the country, which he actually still does have the political capital to do. So that's my main issue in terms of re-election versus kind of doing what's right. And I hope he actually just uses the next few years to do what's right. I mean, I can get a lot more sophisticated than that, but I'll keep it as simple.
Chike Awunugo for PhD. Mm-hmm. It has been such a pleasure. Really appreciate it. I know that you are in the middle of a very busy period right now, and it means a lot to me that you took the time to slow down and have this conversation with me. And I'll be checking back with you in future.
Anytime. Thank you so much for having me on. I really love what you're doing. Keep it going, and don't forget about me.
I love you, Dr. Chike. You take care.
All right.
I reached Dr. Chike Ogbunagafor in New Haven, Connecticut. His latest article is among the advanced online publications of the Cold Spring Harbor Annual Symposia on Quantitative Biology. You'll find links at our website, terralakeshow.com.
I celebrate Thanksgiving, Christmas, traditional American holidays. I'm not feeling the holiday spirit right now. Yes, it's different because of the economy. I'm like struggling right now. Typically, I buy gifts for everyone in my family. This year, no one's getting anything till the new year. So gotta wait till things pick up and get better.
LaVon Green is 23 and hails from Oxford, North Carolina. She spoke to me while on a break near her place of work, Book Warehouse at Durham's Northgate Mall. The discount store is one of too many local casualties of the recession here in North Carolina. The small staff is currently selling off its inventory, and the shop is set to close for good just a couple of weeks from now, in mid-January 2010. December 2009 brings with it the close of a most remarkable year, one that saw the inauguration of America's first openly African-descended president, Barack Obama, and an extraordinary amount of media coverage on President Obama and his administration, who have begun the very slow work of changing the face of America in the world. It also brought us some tragic and difficult stories. The violent deaths of too many children, the passing of entertainment icons and idols, and there were this year's media obsessions, not the least of which were the misfortunes of so-called reality television personalities and those of prominent athletes. Yet on main streets and Martin Luther King boulevards across the country, families struggle to make ends meet while corporations seem to be the largest beneficiaries of the government's diluted remedies for the Great Recession. Many promises made at all levels of elected office began to look a lot more like forgotten suggestions. Too many slipped deeper into debt, poverty, or despair, and amid what seemed like a new level of media mayhem, there was less information, less coverage of everyday folks, less hope. It was easy to tune out, to turn away, to let our energy wane just a bit. But if 2009 has taught us anything, it's that we can't afford to sleep on our futures. The outcomes of broken promises coupled with the public's exhaustion were increasingly evident in 2009, as many working-class African-American communities caught a wicked case of economic swine flu,
the waves of which were felt in various communities of color, and a significant number of working white communities caught one heck of a cold. Meanwhile, many wealthy executives, including those at the root of our ailments, never suffered so much as a sniffle, with some racking up record profits and issuing some of the biggest bonuses in recent record, all without even having the decency to clean up their tracks, boldly living off the little fat left on working America's lean dimes. You didn't have to be of color, female, poor, sick, military, gay, artist, or fill in the blank to notice the paltry promises broken or delayed, or the glitz, glam, and theater served up in the place of delivery. You didn't even have to be a grown-up to feel the repercussions of inaction at every level. And that is perhaps where sonorous silence and short memories cost us the most this year, in the lives of our youth. 2009's heartbreaking stories of children in peril were chilling reminders of the real cost of strain on America's families and support systems. There was Shania Davis, the 5-year-old little girl, found raped and strangled to death in Fayetteville, North Carolina, after allegedly being prostituted by her own mother. And Darian Albert, the 16-year-old honor student, beaten to death by a group of his peers on a Chicago schoolyard. And the teenaged girl in Richmond, California, raped and beaten for 2 hours by 10 schoolmates who were egged on by 20 more on high school grounds during a homecoming dance. Reportedly, there were even a number of adults in the area who heard of the attack and did nothing. And so the unthinkable continued until finally someone stepped up, made a call, saved a life. If only that call had come early enough to save Shania's life or Darian's. The fact is, there were opportunities to prevent all of these tragedies. Someone heard something that just didn't seem right, or noticed evidence of abuse or witnessed signs of anger and gang violence raging out of control. Someone should have made the call and didn't. Years ago, a woman taught me that whenever I pointed the finger at someone else, I'd always find 3 more pointing back at me. You know, it's all too easy to lay the blame on leaders, the media, the internet, in the face of what's wrong in our government, our neighborhoods, and in our homes. But family, in 2010, I'm focusing on the other 3 fingers. Let's resolve to emulate those who choose to stop living without and start looking within. Follow the example of those in our community who, in their own way, have rescued one Shania, protected one Darian, sheltered just one teen attending her first high school dance. They've already figured out that we, and not some outside body, already have every solution our communities need. That's the knowledge that's going to help us keep our elected leaders accountable, wake up our economy, and make a difference in the lives of our children and neighbors. In 2010, let's start our own community education programs on our front porches. Let's plant gardens on the roof of our complexes and chat with the kid on the corner. Yes, that kid on the corner. Let's get really real and pick up that little cousin before heading out to that campus lecture. And volunteer at our libraries or school or group homes or our mama's house. Let's learn some names in our neighborhoods, and then speak to each other. And while we're at it, let's talk to our elders and listen and write it down. Let's raise money for our institutions and have a little fun doing it. Let's find a safe space for our communities or make one. And let's show compassion to our friends and loved ones who most need our support. In the new year, we can wake each other up. We can take vigilance to a new level and give our communities the gift of our show enough, alert action, and wide awake love. Somebody make me a t-shirt. Something like 2010, the year of the homegrown, soulful solution revival. I'm Tara Lake for the Tara Lake Show. Thanks so much for stopping by to listen. I hope you'll join me next time. For information about any of the segments you heard today, please drop by the website at taralakeshow.com. Before we end the show, I wanted to take a moment to make a small tribute. While preparing the music for this show, I realized that 2009 marked the first Christmas season without the beloved Eartha Kitt since she changed the holiday music scene forever with her 1953 recording of the deliciously naughty tune, Santa Baby. In the 1960s, she would do the same for television with her role as Catwoman in the series Batman. Kitt had a special way of altering everything she touched for the better, teaching us all with a fearsome purr and an astonishing power, beauty, and courage. She did battle for every cause that moved her. Freedom for African Americans, an end to the Vietnam War, equal rights for gays and lesbians, victory in her own battle with colon cancer. And she did it all with a grace and style that defied hate, illness, even time. Eartha Kitt departed this life on Christmas Day, December 25th, 2008. She was 81 years old.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, a 54 convertible to light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Think of all the fun I've missed. Think of all the fellas that I've missed.